the godfather of cyberspace and the guardian of black universalism, Mr. Cedric Muhammad.
Here's Mike Tyson again. I might tear up again. Listen closely.
So I went over there and I wanted to box him. He hit me in the stomach.
Oh, this is when Mike came out of jail, was about to get out of jail. Okay, he's boxing in jail. Or I would say a youth detention facility.
I never felt the feeling. I just felt like I died. He's right in the solar plexus. I went down. I said, I just knew I was going to beat this little white man. No way he was going to be. I thought it was a tough one. He hit me in the solar plexus. I never felt. I just went down. I jumped back up to show I was tough, but I couldn't feel anything. It's my whole blood sugar. Everything stopped. I said, what? I couldn't talk. I couldn't breathe. I don't know what the hell happened. He told me to walk around. Because he didn't want, because I tried to show that I was tough, but he knew I was hurt, so he said, walk it off. So I walked around, and after we finished boxing, I said, can you teach me some more of that, sir? He told me, you don't want to learn. And he said, everybody said they want to learn. So I had to continue to prove to him that I wanted to learn by conducting my behavior well. After I talked to people nice, I became a gentleman, and then eventually my grades got better, and then he started teaching me how to box. And once he started teaching me how to box, he realized I was getting close to going on parole to go back to Brooklyn. He said, I don't want you to go back to Brooklyn because you're going to get in trouble and get killed or go to jail. I want you to go to this man. This guy could take you to the next level. And at that time, I was probably 1980. I'm at Customato.
You got to score points when you get in. That's it. Score points when you're doing the amateur.
I didn't trust him because I didn't trust anybody but Bobby Stewart at that particular time. And it was like he was transferring me over to another person, and I didn't trust anybody but him. And then he was like giving me to this guy. I said, what the heck is going on here? And I couldn't understand it, but he said, just trust this man. Trust this man.
I don't trust anybody in general. I don't like people to know me at all. And I just recently trust him because the same much I trust him, I guess he trusts me, and he trusts me a lot. So, but no one really knows Mike Tyson. Nobody's really friendly with Mike Tyson.
Why?
Except
Customato. Customato would watch me for like, he didn't let me box. He would just talk to me for like 2 or 3 weeks about fighting and the psychology of fighting. And what fighting was truly about, fighting wasn't nothing physical, it was all spiritual. And he was saying, if you don't have the spiritual warrior in you, you'll never be a good fighter. I don't care how big or strong you are. And he explained that to me.
Your mind is not in your way. Your mind is not in your way. There's something distracting you.
As time was going on, this guy would just kept saying these great things about us. This guy, I didn't know this guy was queer. He just kept saying great things. He said, man, you're a great fighter. He just kept saying, you're the greatest. You do splendid. You look great. You're looking better. He just kept giving me compliments and compliments about everything I did. So what's the role of this guy? I never had the slightest idea. He was just building up my confidence. But as time went on, I understood what he was doing. As I became an adult, I understood he was building up my confidence. And we started fighting. I had my first amateur fight, and I was so scared of my first amateur fight. I went downstairs and said, I'm going to go to the store. It was in the Bronx, New York. I said, I'm going to the store to my training. I went downstairs, and I said, man, I should get on this training. It's never come back. I wanted to get on the training. It's leave. I was so scared. I didn't want to fight anybody. It's just such a different dynamic than fighting somebody in the ring than it is fighting somebody in the street. And I never thought I could fight somebody. Even after all the training, I was it's totally intimidated fighting somebody in the ring. But I put myself together with the discipline I learned from Cus, and I went in the ring and I scored a third round knockout. I don't know, but after the first, it was too nerve-wracking fighting, I thought at first. So I didn't really want to fight, really. So I was staying at Cus' house. You know, I come from a really poverty-stricken area, and when I came to live with Cus, they live in a 14-room Victorian mansion. And I first come here, I said, wow, I could rob these white guys, these white motherfuckers, being hip, not thinking, I'm not knowing this guy been around the world a bunch of times. I never knew he was like me. He was from a bad neighborhood. He was a street kid like me. And then one day he used to just say, listen, you have the chance to change your life, your family's life. You could be something very special. Don't you want to be champion? You could be champion of the world. And I didn't pay no attention to it. He said, really? You could be champion of the world. You could devastate the world. No man could take you with you. This guy believed it. I looked at this guy, and then I started thinking. I said, I said, this guy's really crazy. That's what I said, this guy's crazy. He said, you do what I tell you to do, and if it doesn't work, then you could leave. So I said, okay, bet. So I did everything he told me to do, and I won every championship from the amateur championship. Oh, I won all the championships. I'm gonna cry. So I won every championship that he told me, because he told me what to do. And I started believing in this old man. I stopped being a little thief. I used to go back to New York and rob people and then come back upstate and hide out. Then I stopped doing all that. I changed my whole life. I said, I'm gonna stick to this boxing shit.
Master, there you go. Now you got, again. Who's the last guy to stop? Time. Very good, that's why.
I turned my whole life over to boxing. I turned into a complete animal. I turned into a disciplinarian. This guy had me clean my room. This guy brainwashed me so much that if he told me to bite, I bite. If he told me anything, I was like his dog. He broke me down. He broke me down and rebuilt me. I was just like a total different person.
Mostly just changed my life because he helped me to deal with people. I know how to deal with people now. Before, I couldn't talk to people. I always want to be alone. And now I learned how to deal with anyone. I could talk to anyone, even about their problems. And it's like a father and son relationship. You know, even though he is my manager and trainer, sometimes I forget that because of the way we are. The first day he met me, he took me in his house. He didn't even know me.
I can say honestly, I have a very deep affection for him. I do. To me, he's my boy. He's with me. But I often say to him, you know, I owe you a lot, and he doesn't know what I mean, but I'm going to tell him now what I mean. If he weren't here, I probably wouldn't be alive today. The fact that he is here and doing what he's doing and doing as well as he's doing and improving as he has gives me the motivation and interest to stay alive, because I believe that a person dies when they no longer wants to live. But I have a reason with Mike here. And he gives me the motivation. I will stay alive, and I will watch him become a success, because I will not leave until that happens.
Beautiful. Beautiful. I teared up when I saw that. Even what Customato said afterward was equally powerful, because he was explaining that it was Mike Tyson who was giving him a reason to live. He's old, you know, he's up in years, older. But this young man gave him a reason to live. Now, you know, I can honestly say that the initial reaction to seeing a white tutor of a young man, especially an athlete, it gives you pause. But how did the black men in Mike Tyson's life that came after Customato treat him compared to Cus? I mean, just look at what happened to Mike after he left the white folks. That's right, I said it. Did Mike get better when he started hanging around us? Or did he go down? It wasn't about color. It was the trust in the relationship. It was the confidence that Customato instilled in Mike. Anyone could have done it. Didn't matter what color you were. Some may say, well, I prefer it would have been a black person. Well, it was a white person. So deal with that. That's not political ideology. Nobody didn't pull out no books on France Fanon and the Communist Manifesto or von Hayek. It wasn't any libertarian literature. It was the teacher-student relationship, mentor-protege, disciple-teacher. And Mike eventually bought in, and Cus bought in, and look at what happened. That's the end of the story, the narrative that I've been writing with Michael Vick, Marion Barry, Mike Tyson. I started at the beginning. Started where Mike Vick is now. We went through the trajectory of Marion Barry, and then we went back to the beginning of Mike Tyson's life in boxing. That's the formula. You get to a young person, boy, girl, and you groom them and you mentor them. And you get them not just to believe in you, but to believe in yourself. A lot of people teach some to believe in them or believe in others and not themselves. You have to believe in yourself. So whoever comes along and can do that for you, build up your self-esteem, build up your confidence. That's a person who is a true friend. Not just someone who wants you to depend on them. And you have to know when to also cut the umbilical cord to a degree. Now, I take Wing Chun. I used to, not regularly now. But there's things that your Sifu or your teacher can do that you would think you're going to die. But the trust and the faith that you can have in another person, if they don't violate that trust, it's one of the most powerful things to build you up. So Customato put himself in Mike, and Mike in return gave Cus a reason for living. Beautiful story. Colorblind to me, colorless. And nobody obviously could take Cus's place in Mike's heart or Mike's mind. But watch that Mike Tyson DVD. Let me give you the, I think I have the cover of that. Excellent. So I want to thank Mark and Brother Charles for putting me on to that. Highly recommend that. You learn a lot more about Mike, and I think it's instructive. Also very inspiring. And Mike is just a beautiful person. You see his heart, his sins, all before the world, as I said last week. These are the qualities that make Marion Barry, Tupac, and a few others endearing. No pretense with them. Okay, send in your comments. I want to talk about, speaking of white men, let me talk about the late Bob Novak. Conservative columnist Bob Novak. Now, I met Bob Novak, I think, in 1998 or 99. I was introduced to him by Jude Winiski, who was a mutual friend of ours, head of Polyconomics. Bob Novak and I have like the same, our birthdays are together, so we would occasionally, when we were ever together around, we happened to be around each other one day around our birthday, so real had to recognize real. But there's some articles up at blackelectorate.com. You can Google Bob Novak and you'll see the realness in one respect. I don't care. I'm not too much into Bob Novak during the George W. Bush years or any of that. I'm into the Bob Novak that had the courage to criticize Israel. So all these black columnists. Now check this out now. I'm going to flip it. I'm going to show you how political ideology will have you chasing your tail. There are a lot of black opinion leaders who don't like Bob Novak because of his Republican Party affiliation. But they were not the man that he was in terms of speaking honestly about the Middle East conflict. So you have blacks on the left who can't stand Bob Novak because he was Republican, but they don't have the heart to criticize Israel when Israel is wrong, or U.S. foreign policy, which may disproportionately favor Israel. So who really is a friend of certain principles? You got people on the left scared to death to say anything in favor of the Palestinian people, and then want to say Bob Novak is evil because he down with the Republican crew. There's an article up on Black Electorate. Let me give you some of the audio on that, some of the written word on that. Just Google Bob Novak. Cut through all the Democrat Republican stuff. Get to the bottom line. What was his position on Israel and foreign policy? Now here's the Jewish Week. We have a story up from the Jewish Week. Novak remembered as a biased critic of Israel. Robert Novak, the conservative newspaper columnist and television commentator who died Tuesday after a year-long battle with brain cancer, often drew the ire of the Jewish community for his frequent criticism of Israel. Mr. Novak, who was 78, wrote the syndicated Inside Report column for 30 years with the late Roland Evans, often depicting the pro-Israel lobby as excessively influential in Washington. You got black opinion leaders that don't got the heart to do that. Card-carrying Democrats. Talking about they on the left. No, you're on the plantation. That means you can't say nothing in favor of the Palestinian people or in support of justice. Novak later wrote that the United States' unjustified war in Iraq was launched largely for Israeli interests, and that the 9/11 attacks on the country were the result of terrorists' hatred of Israel. This is what the Jewish Weekly is saying. He also praised former President Jimmy Carter for calling Israel's treatment of Palestinians apartheid, and he suggested that the Republican Party could make common cause with Minister Louis Farrakhan of the Nation of Islam. Quote, he was not a friend of Israel and the Jewish people, end quote, said Abraham Foxman, national director of the Anti-Defamation League. He was a curmudgeon who did not miss an opportunity to express his bias against Israel. This is what Abraham Foxman said. Now, some of you out there, you civil rights leaders, you up there standing with Abraham Foxman. You standing with Abraham Foxman, ADL, who spied on civil rights leaders. The Anti-Defamation League spies on black civil rights organizations. You going to side with him and criticize Bob Novak. You're a slave. You civil rights leaders that do that, not all of you, but those of you that do that, you're a slave. The ADL spies on civil rights leaders, breaks into their office. Yet you, because you're getting some money, you'll stand there with the Anti-Defamation League and Abraham Foxman. Anti-black. The Anti-Defamation League is anti-black. But you sit there and support them because you're getting some money. Let's keep it real. Bob Novak wasn't like that. He was getting his own money. He was a media entrepreneur. That's why he was able to speak truthfully. He was getting money writing his columns. And he was getting money. He was getting money because he was getting money. But he was a media entrepreneur, so he didn't have to rely on somebody's charity or philanthropy. So he didn't have to bite his tongue. So that's my memory of Bob Novak. All you Republican haters, go somewhere. Standing up there with Abraham Foxman in the ADL. The civil rights leader. Civil rights activists supporting that nonsense. And I said that over a DJ Premier beat. Yes, the Kenyan cab is on. Cedric Muhammad Black Coffee Program, August 19th, 2009. Now, it's very hard to find a civil rights organization that's not scared of the Anti-Defamation League, but just do the history. Did the Anti-Defamation League spy on black organizations? Now, this is a Gangster of the Week segment. I've got two nominees. I already have decided who it is. I want to nominate a consolation prize of sorts. Raila Odinga, the Prime Minister of Kenya, not biting his tongue with Fareed Zakaria on GPS. If you saw that, let me know. Now, the Gangster of the Week are the 10 percenters who have tricked all of us into giving them control or access to our bank deposits because their investment banking businesses went under. They may be the gangster of the year, all of the banks that apply to be bank holding companies so that they could legally be allowed to have access to use your deposit money in banks. Some of you look at me. We started the Black Owned Bank Initiative, blackownedbank.com. Tried to tell you the importance of your deposits. And you all keep your money in the other people's banks. Cool, no problem. The other people can sponsor this program if they would like. But you're not serious about building nothing, or else you would have seen that your deposits were the key to surviving this madness. So the small and community and independent owned banks are going under, only to be bought up by the major banks who were slick enough to get out of investment banking and start to become bank holding companies. They are the gangsters of the week, hands down. I'm going to read you some information on that momentarily. But we have a new prize, a new category. We call it the Minister on Donahue Award. And this week's recipient is Prime Minister Raila Odinga from Kenya for not backing down, speaking truthfully to others. It's the Minister on Donahue Award because of this. Here's the Minister on Donahue years ago. The Prime Minister of Kenya gets this award.
You know what I think? I think you've given up. Given up on what? On the ideal of an integrated America. The dream of Martin Luther King. I think you've given up. I'm not trying to be a smart aleck now. I'm telling you honestly that I think you've given up.
You know, it's interesting how white folks sit here thinking that I have a reason to lie to you, as though you are so powerful and you are so wonderful that I'm so ashamed of my words that I have to twist and turn. Please, you're not dealing with that kind of man. You're dealing with a man who means what he says and says what he means. Now listen.
Now here's Raila Odinga. What did he say that earned him the Minister on Donahue Award?
When I was in Nairobi last week, I heard a quote that speaks volumes about the struggle for democracy all over the African continent. Listen to this, quote, "In Africa, elections are never won. They are rigged. The loser does not accept the results, and then we move on." That quote comes from the Prime Minister of Kenya, Raila Odinga. Prime Minister Odinga is a well-known dissident whose struggles for democracy in his country have led to years of imprisonment. In 2007, Odinga ran for president of Kenya, taking on the incumbent, Mwai Kibaki. It was by all accounts a close election, but the official tally indicated that Odinga had lost. Those results were widely disputed, and almost everyone agrees that some kind of fraud went on. Rioting erupted across the country. An estimated 1,200 people were killed. Ultimately, though, Odinga did a kind of about-face. He made a power-sharing agreement with the incumbent president, Mwai Kibaki. Many believe he sold out and is now part of the problem. Naturally, he feels otherwise. Last week, while I was in Kenya, I interviewed Prime Minister Odinga. I asked him about Americans lecturing him, about democracy, about corruption, and about much more. Prime Minister Odinga, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm very happy to join.
Recently, you had Secretary of State Hillary Clinton visiting you as a guest. And after she made some remarks, you publicly said, "We do not need lectures on governance from outsiders." Now, I was struck by that because, of course, you were a political dissident, a political prisoner, and urgently screamed for external assistance when you wanted to bring democracy to Kenya.
I'm saying that the United States need to talk much more about trade and wealth creation to Africa. We know ourselves, we are not doing what we are doing to democratize Africa because we want to placate somebody, we want to please somebody. We are doing it because it is right for us. And Africans have paid a bigger price for democracy. And we really know clearly where we want to take the African continent. So I've been saying that, yes, partnership we want to accept, but not patronage. You see, we don't want to be lectured on what's right, what's wrong. After all, even the American democracy is not perfect. The example is the Florida event with Bush and Al Gore.
This is a call to adhere to certain international standards and rights. And as you say, and you point out, there are obstacles in this process. Why not have the American Secretary of State mention it?
I don't mind her saying it. What I said is that we should not just be lectured to, like students. I mean, if she went to Riyadh in Saudi Arabia, she would not be talking the same language there. And what democracy do you have there in Saudi Arabia? How about in Jordan? How about in Egypt? Why must it just be when you come here? If you believe really, truly on democracy and good governance and so on, then you must speak the same language all over wherever you go.
Would you say the same to Barack Obama if he were to to make these points, because in his video message to the conference, he said some very similar things.
Yes, I mean, why not? I would say it. See, Kenya is not a client state of any government. We also recognize that we have got certain weaknesses, which we are working on, which we must improve. I speak very candidly to President Kibaki when I disagree with him on this issue. Our Kenyans know that. So I'm known to be speaking my mind all the times. I spoke very strongly to Robert Mugabe until he declared me a persona non grata in Zimbabwe. I've spoken on the issues of the poor, on the violations of human rights in the whole of the African continent. And I say that we as Africans do not wait to be told by foreigners what we need to do for Africa. I'm a Pan-Africanist. I believe in the ability of the African people to develop the African continent.
Let me ask you finally, Prime Minister, just a question. We alluded to it earlier, but you are a political dissident. You've spent 18 years in jail. Mm-hmm. Do you ever look around the Prime Minister's office and think to yourself, this is very different from what you had expected when you were in jail?
Well, as you know, that when you're in jail, deprived of everything that endears us to life, and surrounded by every condition that could excite passion and resentment, you think about very many things. But when you come out and you continue the struggle like we did, and you arrive at here, you say that this is a stage, it is a stop on our way forward. So I do not consider this as my destination. I see this as just one stage.
What is your destination?
And destination is the complete democratization of the Kenyan society, complete emasculation of our people. I believe in the Kenyan dream, which is, you find in our national anthem, to make this country free, liberated, independent, democratic, and prosperous. And I think that we're far away from that. But I want us to make continuous movements towards that destination.
Prime Minister Odinga, pleasure to have you.
Thank you.
Prime Minister of Kenya, Raila Odinga, not backing down from saying, he said, I'll say it to President Obama. Don't matter. Whoever wants it. What did Jay-Z say? Whether at the Garden or flowing on Clue, whatever you want to do, it's all right with me. Raila Odinga did not back down. Said, Hillary, get out of here with that. Go to Saudi Arabia and Egypt with your lectures on governance, democracy, and corruption. For that, Prime Minister Odinga, we give you the Minister on Donahue Award, my brother.
You know what I think? I think you've given up. Given up on what? On the ideal of an integrated America. The dream of Martin Luther King. I think you've given up. I'm not trying to be a smart aleck now. I'm telling you honestly that I think you've given up. You know, it's interesting how white folks sit here thinking that I have a reason to lie to you, as though you are so powerful and you are so wonderful, and I'm so ashamed of my words that I have to twist and turn. Please, you're not dealing with that kind of man. You're dealing with a man who means what he says and says what he means. Now listen.
Mark M., my brother from another mother, he says, brother, you are right. Raila Odinga did talk the talk to the reporter. I just hope he does the same when it comes to foreign aid, the World Trade Organization, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and of course China, the U.S., and the EU. Easy now. Slow down. Pump the brakes. Let's just work on the reporters for now, Mark. Now, speaking of Mark, he knows I've been on top of this this effort by the 10% to come after our bank deposits. And it's a year, 1 year anniversary since this bamboozlement went on. I'm going to read you the article that I held up then and I hold it up now. Some people wonder why we should be trying to pool capital in the community at community banks, small minority-owned banks, quote-unquote. That's because everybody but us seems to understand the power of a bank deposit. Now, here's the original article that got me on my job as far as trying to wave the flag you all down. September 22nd, 2008, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley scrap Wall Street model becoming banks in bid to ride out crisis. The end of the traditional investment banking as storied firms face closer supervision and stringent new capital requirements. The Federal Reserve, in an attempt to prevent the crisis on Wall Street from infecting its two premier institutions, took the extraordinary measure on Sunday night of agreeing to convert investment banks Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs Group Inc. into traditional bank holding companies. With the move, Wall Street, as it has long been known, a coterie of independent brokerage firms, will cease to exist. Wall Street's two prestigious institutions will come under the close supervision of national bank regulators, subjecting them to new capital requirements, additional oversight, and far less profitability than they have historically enjoyed. Now, why did this happen? What was the motivation? This is the September 22nd, 2008 article in the Wall Street Journal. It says the huge banking firms that have so far survived the credit market turmoil, Citigroup Inc., Bank of America, JP Morgan Chase, and Wachovia Corporation and Wells Fargo, each have bank holding companies overseen by the Fed and national bank charters supervised by the Treasury Department's Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. They can count on their huge deposit bases. Deposit bases, that means your money in your savings account and your checking account. They can count on their huge deposit bases to serve as an alternative source of funding to other more unpredictable liquidity sources. Let me go down again. Same article, September 22nd, 2008, Wall Street Journal. The Federal Reserve will regulate the parent companies. The Comptroller of the Currency will oversee the national bank charters, and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corp will likely play a bigger role because the companies are expected to seek much higher volumes of federally backed deposits. One more. As bank holding companies, Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs will be allowed to take customer deposits, potentially a more stable source of funding. Now, I'm going to put this material out in post show notes. But the greatest hustle, perhaps, of all time, the most gangster move of the last year, is certainly these banks that became bank holding companies in order to use deposits. By the way, FDIC insured deposits. Here's an article from July of this year, July 27th. It's called Wells Fargo Buys Mortgage Bonds as Defaults Rise, Bloomberg. In a section called Deploying Deposits, this article says, banks are buying mortgage-backed securities to put increased deposits to work as tighter lending standards and lower demand limit new loans. See, they're not giving you loans, but they're putting the money in the same risky garbage that got us into this mess, using your bank deposits. Again, banks are buying mortgage-backed securities to put increased deposits to work as tighter lending standards and lower demand limit new loans. This is why when I defend One United Bank, I mean, it's amazing. No one will defend One United Bank, who only got $12 million in TARP money. But you all will leave your money in some of these other banks who are putting your money in mortgage-backed securities. Now, let me go down. This is a little 10% hustle for bank deposits kit, courtesy of Mark from D.C., my brother from another mother. I'm going to send this out. 8 articles here, all together. One of them from Naked Capitalism is called Banks Want Your Deposits to Trade But Not to Lend You Money. Another one he has here is the Wall Street Journal reports that CIT just asked the Federal Reserve if it could use some of the deposits in a bank it owns in Utah to purchase some of its toxic assets and keep the company going by trading trash for cash. Your cash, family. Another article. Back in 2008, to help close the Bank of America purchase of Merrill Lynch, the Federal Reserve suspended the rule preventing banks from using deposits to fund investments. These are your bank deposits. Those are you that have deposits in these banks. I told you a year ago that this is what they were going to do. Why don't you do something with your deposits? This is why I say, go see the movie Defiance. I think the minister recommended this movie. I saw the movie Defiance. I don't know if you've seen it. It's about a Jewish community that has their back against the wall. They're in self-preservation mode. These companies went and became banks overnight. Not only does it allow them to have access to your bank deposits, it also allows them to use accounting tricks. They have their money accounted in different ways that are more beneficial to them as bank holding companies than as investment banks. I'm going to send this out tomorrow on post show notes. Not that anybody's going to do anything to stop it, but at least you'll know what the 10% are up to. But again, this all started with an article that I read last year. We were promoting why you should put your money in black-owned banks and community banks. And people were like, oh, I don't know, I don't get it. And the next thing you know, the bottom fell out of the commercial banking industry and people were worried about where to put their money. Well, that was a perfect opportunity, again, for folks to start buying stock in their local banks, leveraging the power of their deposits. This is what we were trying to do. Folks got scared and left their money in the big banks. Just ask around. Ask folks, where do you bank? Do you bank at a community-oriented bank? Or do you bank at one of the major institutions that had to get bailed out by the Federal Reserve? This is why Joseph from Brooklyn and some of the others are correct in suspecting whether people really would embrace Michael Vick or would they be scared to be associated with him. I hadn't thought about that. You still have that stigma. Other folks have to vouch for somebody in order for you to deal with them. I think that's gangster. Let's switch up the music. Goldman Sachs, I will not take your advertisement. So I will name you. Some of the other banks, I'll take your money. Because it's really our money. It's our deposits that you're using anyway. This is gangster. Yo, hey yo, listen to this gangster. Feel this music, man. Get into this gangster. Ooh, this is gangster. Taking your bank deposits to buy mortgage-backed securities. Trash for cash. You don't even know about it. Now let's get down to business. I've been gone for a minute, but I'm back now, down for business. Yeah, I found the small town I had to visit. Had a bunch of hungry workers who was down and get it. So I got up and left, hit the town with... Know the rules are getting mad. Wells Fargo. Banks buying mortgage-backed securities to put increased deposits to work as tighter lending standards and lower demand limit new loans. That means they're not giving you a loan for a college loan. They're not giving you money for your small business. Credit card standards getting tighter, but they're putting your money in mortgage-backed securities, baby. September 22nd, 2008, the article, if you want to get it. Goldman and Morgan scrap Wall Street model to become banks in bid to ride out crisis. That's real gangster. Get into this gangster, cause this is just for gangster. Hey, yo, listen to this gangster. I'm feeling Raila Odinga, the Prime Minister of Kenya, but there's nothing more gangster than tricking the people into leaving banks that were about to go under and then taking it to buy mortgage-backed securities. Gangsters that are black out, gout, blank out, gout it, yeah, and looking lost, lost. Took your place, gave the crooks the fork, we gonna eat whether it's fish or pork, they thirsty and ready to take your burger, turkey and veggie. You ever work with machetes? I broke bread with billionaires that they flipping. Patty, they soon serve with semi. My tune turn to envy. Balloon pop, you know I burn the friendly and pull cars off. Huh. I'm so nice, I took the last two bars off. Rob from California, he says, I'm late, but I'm here. Obama's weakest link is his obvious allegiance to the minions of Robert Rubin. The wise one, as smart as brother president seems to be, he lacks more than a reasonable amount of judgment in his choice of financial advisors. He's weak to the biggest money scammers of the last three decades. By the way, I did see that movie Defiance, and I recommend it for anybody needing to see how to pull a community up by their own means and skills. Defiance. It's worth that $4.99 if you got it on Comcast on demand. Do it. Goldman Sachs, do it. Keep doing it until these 85ers figure out what's up. Keep taking their money so they put it in their own local community-owned institutions.
I got you exhausted. You gotta be nauseous how I pull up, stop and be crossing. Chrome wheels spinning out of proportion. Twin pipes on the back, letting out the exhaustion. Whoa, kids love me, but I'm no idol. I hope, dog, my spit game is so vital. I'm with the game's been missing like both.
Under 71. From Philly, he says, peace. Did you knowledge Thomas 15X Khalil Islam, who was falsely accused of murdering Malcolm X and served 22 years in prison, returning to the essence? Peace, Under. Thank you, Under. I want to acknowledge Khalil Islam. There's a book on the assassination of Malcolm that I have. I wanted to recommend. I don't have it in front of me. Peace. Go get it, Goldman Sachs, Wells Fargo. Take this money from these 85ers out here. Party in the mess hall. This shit just for gangsters. Pardon all the rest of y'all. Juel Santana, make it happen, man. Dipset grip, Harlem home. Send to this gangster. Fearless music, man. Get into this gangster. Yeah. This shit just for gangsters. Where my n***s at? Where my n***s at? Get into this gangster, cause this shit just for gangsters. Hey, yo, listen to this gangster. Fearless music, man. Get into this gangster, cause this shit just for gangsters. Where my n***s at? Where my get into this gangster, cause this is just for gangsters.
You are tuned in to The Watchman, Cedric Muhammad, on the Black Coffee Channel.
What about all that preaching you do back home, Bishop? Don't you believe in God?
Well, now I believe in it at the time I'm preaching it. Then I don't believe in it no more. Hell, now I just believe in the pictures of old white men on green paper.
Well, that ain't no way to live. You know, God don't like ugly, Bishop.
He ain't too fond of pretty either. Train, why you think? Why you think God allowed all this killing all over the world to happen? See? See, that's why I don't believe in him.
Well, if you don't believe in him, Bishop Cumming, then... well, then why you care about whether or not God the one allowing all the killing?
You are tuned in to The Watchman, Cedric Muhammad, on the Black Coffee Channel.
to the bottom. See the faces of the people that I shot. When I get high late night, flow through the bottom. My aunt house, one of the places that I shot. She just died. She got cancer from smoking and drinking the same that I'm drinking and smoking. I can't lie. Wish life would just open its handcuffs and let me go. Feel like I'm doing a bit. I can't slide. So what? I'm a rapper. I can't escape wrath of a law. If I crash up, I whip or get blast in the jaw. Prick mashed in the spit. Or I might go triple platinum. Become a household name. After a long day, I'm out of town. Work, make my way to the plane. Mashed in the trip. Here, mayday, mayday. Controls out of work. How on earth can life end like this? Nowhere to go.
To the Watchman, Cedric Muhammad, on the Black Coffee Channel. You are tuned in to the Watchman, Cedric Muhammad, on the Black Coffee Channel.
Africa, I greet you in the name of the Universal Negro Improvement Association and Affinities League of the World. You may ask, what organization is that? It is for me to inform you that the Universal Negro Improvement Association is an organization that seeks to unite into one solid body the 400 million Negroes of the world, to link up the 15 million Negroes of the United States of America with the 20 million Negroes of the West Indies, the 40 million Negroes of South and Central America, with the 280 million Negroes of Africa, for the purpose of bettering our industrial, commercial, educational, social, and political conditions. As you are aware, the world in which we live today is divided into stress groups and distinct nationalities. Each race and each nationality is endeavoring to work out its own destiny to the exclusion of other races and other nationalities. We hear the cry of England for the Englishman, of France for the Frenchman, of Germany for the German, of Ireland for the Irish, of Palestine for the Jew, of Japan for the Japanese, of China for the Chinese. We of the Universal Negro Improvement Association are raising the cry of Africa for the Africans, those at home and those abroad. There are 400 million Africans in the world who have Negro blood coursing through their veins. And we believe that the time has come to unite these 400 million people for the one common purpose of bettering their condition. The great problem of the Negro for the last 500 years has been that of disunity. No one or no organization ever succeeded in uniting the Negro race. But within the last 4 years, the Universal Negro Improvement Association has worked wonders in bringing together in one fold 4 million organized Negroes who are scattered in all parts of the world, being in the 48 states of the American Union, all the West Indian Islands, and the countries of South and Central America and Africa. These 4 million people are working to convert the rest of the 400 million scattered all over the world, and it is for this purpose that we are asking you to join our ranks and to do the best you can to help us to bring about an emancipated race. If anything praiseworthy is to be done, it must be done through unity. And it is for that reason that the Universal Negro Improvement Association calls upon every Negro in the United States to rally to its standards. We want to unite the Negro race in this country. We want every Negro to work for one common object, that of building a nation of his own on the great continent of Africa. That all Negroes all over the world are working for the establishment of a government in Africa means that it will be realized in another few years. We want the moral and financial support of every Negro to make the dream a possibility. Already, this organization has established itself in Nigeria, West Africa, and is endeavoring to do all possible to develop that Negro country to become a great industrial and commercial commonwealth. Pioneers have been sent by this organization to Nigeria, and they are now laying the foundations upon which the 400 million Negroes of the world will build. If you believe that the Negro has a soul, if you believe that the Negro is a man, if you believe the Negro was endowed with the senses commonly given to other men by the Creator, then you must acknowledge that what other men have done, Negroes can do. We want to build up cities, nations, governments, industries of our own in Africa, so that we'll be able to have a chance to rise from the lowest to the highest position in the African Commonwealth.
Marcus Garvey changed the thinking of the world. He changed the thinking of black men in the United States, that we are Africans. He taught that wherever Africans are is Africa.
Marcus Garvey is a success. Men like Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, all of them took a page out of the UNIA.
Well, one, you can't understand African-American politics, nor the politics of the African diaspora without the history of the Universal Negro Improvement Association, and particularly Marcus Garvey's ideas. In some ways, Garvey was the template for black politics, whether you're talking about Jamaica and Haiti, for that matter, whether you're talking about the Rastafari movement in London, or if you're talking about organizations as distinct as, say, the NAACP. All black nationalist organizations, radical ones, conservative ones, draw somewhat from the Garvey legacy.
His organization crumbled and his businesses collapsed. But Marcus Garvey's impact on the cultural, political, and spiritual life of black people would persist long after his death. One group that played a major role in preserving Garvey's legacy emerged in his native Jamaica in the 1930s. They are known today as Rastafarians.
It's as if his legacy went underground. The Rastafarians are the people, more than anyone, I think, who kept alive his memory after 1940. Garvey's influence on the early Rastafari movement was very profound. The early Rastafarian prophets claimed that Garvey was the John the Baptist, heralding the coming of their great African king, Emperor Haile Selassie.
And Marcus Garvey was the first man that made mention of Haile Selassie in this country. His Majesty crowned 1930, 2nd of November. And Marcus Garvey made mention that from the early 20s. Marcus Garvey changed the world, especially black people, taking away black people's heart and mind and heart from the white men and turning them to Africa. Marcus Garvey caused millions of people to turn their mind to Africa.
Redemption songs. Redemption songs.
But it's the Rastafarians who really made of Garvey a folk hero, a mythic hero of semi-literate, ordinary people. And their contribution to the preservation of Garvey's legacy is immense. Bob Marley, in some ways, in his redemption song and in much of his music, really did try to promote the key elements of Garvey's ideology, even if it wasn't called that.
Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? Is all I ever had.
Another group to inherit Garvey's legacy was the Nation of Islam, which was founded in the 1930s and thrived in the 1950s and 60s.
Ideologically, there's a strong correlation between the Garvey movement and the Nation of Islam movement. That movement would take over many of the ideological themes of Garvey's African redemption, African fundamentalism philosophy. The idea of a nation for black people, a religion for black people, an economic base for black people. All of these themes were already laid out by Garvey. What Elijah Muhammad contributed was an Islamic orientation.
I think Islam
is one of the greatest religions of all time for our people in America. The so-called American Negro have to be completely re-educated.
Garvey's philosophy of black self-reliance would find its greatest champion in a man whose parents were Garveyites, the Nation of Islam's most charismatic leader, Malcolm X.
We are trapped in a vicious cycle of poverty, of ignorance, of apathy, of disease, and of death. And they have these old Uncle Tom Negro leaders coming to Harlem telling you and me that times are getting better. Your times will never get better until you make them better.
If you look at some of the rhetoric of Malcolm X, it almost is the same as Marcus Garvey. You look at the philosophy that Malcolm X followed, black nationalism, which he did not create, but he popularized it. That comes out of the Garvey movement. You know, when you're talking about doing for self, you know, building your own businesses, controlling your own community, that God is of African descent or a black person. Malcolm's philosophy of black nationalism ties in perfectly with the philosophy of Marcus Garvey.
It is not too exaggerated to say that without Garvey and Garveyism, there would have been no Malcolm X, because the foundation of Elijah Muhammad, Malcolm X, and Louis Farrakhan today is really Marcus Garvey.
African leaders seeking an end to European colonial rule after World War II would use Garvey's ideas as guiding principles for their own struggles. Leaders such as Jomo Kenyatta of Kenya, Steve Biko of South Africa, and Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana would embrace Garvey's philosophy of black unity and self-sufficiency.
Garvey left a legacy to Africans today of pride in being Africans, of pride in African culture and African civilization, of pride in being black. That is the legacy that he left to Africans.
Garvey had tremendous influence in various parts of Africa, not only West Africa, which many people point to, but also Southern Africa, Central Africa, East Africa. He was able to influence many individuals and many movements in these particular areas. Kwame Nkrumah probably stands out as one of the most important, because Nkrumah became the first president of independent Ghana, which was formerly the Gold Coast.
The philosophy and opinions of Marcus Garvey had a profound impact on Kwame Nkrumah. Kwame Nkrumah studied in the United States at the end of the 1920s and in the 1930s. And he read quite a lot. And he talked about all these different books that he read, including Marx and so on. But he said quite explicitly that the book that had the greatest impact upon him and his thinking was the philosophy and opinions of Marcus Garvey.
The catchphrase, "Black is beautiful," popularized in the 1960s and 70s, had powerful roots in Garveyism.
When we were growing up, we were not allowed to play with white dolls. We had to have black dolls. Mr. Garvey made sure that people made, they even used to make black dolls. So from then on, you learn from a child to love black. And that's one of the things Mr. Garvey taught.